Happy 4th of July, America. This is Al Harlow, your next-door neighbor, calling from Canada. We were all raised on music here in the North, from Motown to Muddy's Mississippi Delta, from Elvis to Mr. Barry, so glad that he's living in the USA, from California Girls to Dylan to Aretha getting her respect. So back in 1980, we decided Prism's next album, Young and Restless, needed to salute American music. My songwriting partner at the time, Lindsay Mitchell, came up with this, American music. You can hear it all over the world. Right now, somewhere, this minute, there's a radio playing it on. That rhythm and blues, tight dresses, high-heel shoes, with the eye-catch shaking and the four-top singing that same old song. A 12-bar shuffle through a megawatt stereo. You can hear that Texas sound, a blue-eyed soul review, maybe a Midwestern power trio. It's gonna take you on a 4-4 ride, gonna let the drummer be your guide. It's American music. By the way, you're hearing it all on WRCT 88.3 FM, Pittsburgh, USA. So peace and freedom to the greatest democracy in history, still a light shining to the entire world. Happy 4th of July, America.
American music. Happy 4th of July weekend, Pittsburgh. You're listening to WRCT, 88.3 FM, streaming online at WRCT.org. I'm your rockin' attorney, Eric Jackson Lurie, reminding you next Thursday night at 8, we're going to be joined by Rock and Roll Hall of Fame inductee, original Alice Cooper band bassist, Dennis Dunaway. And he's going to be talking about the new Alice Cooper album, which is the first album in over 50 years, reuniting the original Alice Cooper band. Tune in next Thursday night at 8, right here on WRCT, 88.3 FM. American music by Prism, going out to Reach in Perrysville. And before that, Kansas Song for America off their last live album. You're listening to Courts in Session, heard here every Thursday from 8 to 10:30. We're celebrating America, its birth, freedom, liberty, independence, right here on WRCT. So is your neighbor in need? You know, millions of Americans with long-term health needs are struggling to keep that independence. Volunteer by helping to shop, cook, drive, or just say hello. A few hours can make a difference. Faith in Action programs connect you with people in need right in your community. You can call 1-877-FAITH-11 or go to faithinaction.org. That's 1-877-FAITH-11 or faithinaction.org. Got Charlie Daniels on the fiddle in the background. We're getting near the end, but we got some music to play. You know, this final half hour of tonight's show is brought to you by Attic Records, located in Millvale. Attic Records is open 7 days a week. They sell new and used records and CDs from a range of genres, including rock, doo-wop, metal, country, reggae, hip-hop, and much, much more. Attic Records is independently owned, and they buy used records and CDs from collectors in bulk or by unit. Attic Records is located at 513 Grand Avenue in Millvale. For more information, call 412-821-8484 or visit them at atticrecordstore.com. Attic Records are sponsor for this last half hour of tonight's show. Turn up your radio. This is the last release from Crocus. This is Live. You know this song.
Let me be. Don't come hanging around my American girls and American guys, we'll always stand up and salute. We'll always recognize when we see old glory flying. There's a lot of men dead, so we can sleep in peace at night when we lay down our head. My daddy served in the army. We lost his right eye, but he flew a flag out in our yard till the day that he died. He wanted my mother, my brother, my sister and me to grow up and live happy in the land of the free. Now this nation that I love is falling under attack. A mighty sucker punch came flying in from somewhere in the back. Soon as we could see clearly through our big black eye, man, we lit up your world like the 4th of July. Hey, Uncle Sam, put your name at the top of his list. And the Statue of Liberty started shaking her fist. And an eagle will fly, and it's gonna be here. When you hear Mother Freedom start ringing her bell, and it'll feel like the whole wide world is raining down on you. All brought to you courtesy of the red, white, and blue. Served and the battle will rage. This big dog will fight when you rattle his cage. And you'll be sorry that you mess with the U.S. of A. 'Cause we'll put a boot in your ass. It's the American way. Hey, Uncle Sam, put your name at the top of his list. And a statue of a started shaking her fist, and the eagle will fly, and it's gonna be hell when you hear Mother Freedom start ringing her bell, and it'll feel like the whole wide world is raining down on you. I'll brought to you courtesy of the red, white, and blue.
Voices of thunder, it's a new of America. Back in the summer of 85, I met a young girl, her heart was inflamed. Jenny Bowen was her name. She was a California girl. War had changed her whole world. Her daddy died in Vietnam. She lost her husband in Lebanon. She was driving back to Washington to get a medal for the job they done from the president of the United States. America. And she saw hungry people in the street, dumb mothers who could not eat. Oh, I remember American dream. We've all talked of American dream. And it all goes on. Yeah, the dreams go on. And it all goes on. Can you feel it coming? It's like the Green Party in Germany. Young people with visions and dreams. Nicaragua and Chile, Poland and South Africa. Freedom brewing, it's an uphill dream. Don't be afraid of anything. Don't be afraid.
Chuck Berry in the background, Promised Land. Ladies and gentlemen, how lucky are we to live in the Promised Land? 4th of July celebration, courts in session is come to a conclusion. Courts in session is now courts adjourned. Closed out with the KBC band Kantner, Bell, and Cassidy from Jefferson Airplane with their hit America. And before that, Toby Keith with courtesy of the Red, White, and Blue. Well, your phone calls tonight made the show. Terrific requests, great stories. Let's do it all again next Thursday night at 8. Yours truly, EJL, is going to close out the show and head and do a little of my own 4th of July celebrating, going to hydrate. And cheers to freedom, liberty, independence, and being born on the greatest planet on Earth. Ha, greatest nation on the planet. How about that? If you missed any part of tonight's show, you can catch it again this Sunday night at 11 right here on WRCT. And you can catch it again half an hour coming at you out of the West Coast at 1033WWRO.com. I'm your rocking attorney, Eric Jackson Lurie, reminding you to take care of each other. Be kind to each other. And as we're celebrating the 4th of July, be proud to be American. Good night, Pittsburgh. Let's close out with the man himself, Charlie Daniels Band. This is In America.
Under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
As many Zionist leaders acknowledge privately, if not always publicly, anybody would oppose such a thing. Right? Any indigenous population would resist such a thing. And the more far-sighted and hard-headed of the Zionist leaders were already saying very clearly in the 1920s, of course the Arabs will oppose us. And there's no peaceful resolution to this in sight, and the only thing that will decide this is superior force.
That's Zachary Lachman. And this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamyan. This edition of AR features Zachary Lachman on a brief history of Zionism. Zion is the name of a hill in ancient Jerusalem. The Jewish nationalist movement coined the term Zionism in the 1890s. Zionism got the big power backing it was looking for when Britain issued the Balfour Declaration on November 2, 1917, Arthur James Balfour, the British Foreign Secretary, stated, "His Majesty's government view with favor the establishment in Palestine of a national home for the Jewish people." This declaration became the major legal cornerstone for Zionist claims to Palestine. Two issues complicated things. At the time, 90% of Palestine's population was Arab Muslim and Christian, and only 10% Jewish. And the British were signing away land that was not theirs. Our guest today is Zachary Lachman. He's professor of Middle Eastern Studies and History at New York University. He's the author of many books, and he's contributing editor to Middle East Report. This classic from the AR archives was recorded at NYU in 2010. And now, Zachary Lachman, a brief history of Zionism.
I think we can see Zionism as one of a whole series of different and often conflicting responses by Jews in Europe, and especially in Central and Eastern Europe, where most of the Jews lived at the time, to the situation they found themselves in the late 19th century. The great majority of Europe's Jews and of the world's Jews at that time lived in Tsarist Russia, within the Tsarist Empire, where they were discriminated against, often persecuted as Jews, and were also extremely poor in their great majority. In the process of figuring out how to respond to this situation, Zionism was one tendency that emerged. There were lots of others, and others that were much more popular at the time and for decades afterwards. For example, from the 1880s onward, after the wave of anti-Jewish pogroms that erupted in Tsarist Russia, millions of Jews picked up and left. They voted with their feet in a sense and went to other places where they hoped they could live lives that were not subject to persecution and discrimination and find economic opportunity, escape from the terrible poverty in which most Jews in the Tsarist Empire were enmeshed. And this is when we get the mass migration of Jews from Eastern Europe to the United States, and to a lesser extent to Western Europe, South Africa, Argentina, and so forth. And in this sense, Jews were part of a vast wave of millions of emigrants out of Eastern and Central and Southern Europe, most of them non-Jews, escaping poverty, seeking opportunity, in some cases seeking religious or national freedom. So this was one very powerful response. A great many Jews in Eastern Europe stuck to the old ways. They continued to live deeply religious lives. They felt that whatever they endured was God's will, and as long as they lived in accordance with the laws of the Torah, God's commandments as they saw it, this is how it had to be, even as they tried to get through day to day. In Russia and elsewhere, many Jews abandoned the old ways. They felt that the old laws, the old religious commandments, were no longer relevant to their new lives. This period witnessed the spread of education, urbanization, very rapid demographic growth, and many Jews escaped the tutelage, the domination of their rabbis and their close-knit, tightly controlled communities, and became much more secular, and sought advancement either through education, although that didn't get you very far in Tsarist Russia. There were limits to how far Jews could advance. Or they turned to movements for social change. Jews were just one of many oppressed nationalities in Tsarist Russia. And, of course, the great bulk of the population were oppressed in class terms. The great bulk of the peasant population were ruthlessly exploited by their landlords and the urban working class, which was growing very rapidly. So many Jews joined the clandestine movements, parties, organizations that fought to end Tsarist oppression, to overthrow the Tsarist regime and create a democratic and socialist Russia in which Jews with all the other oppressed nationalities would have equal rights. And this is why Jews played a very disproportionate role, a very disproportionately large role in all the movements of opposition to the Tsarist regime, including the left-wing movements, the socialist movements, including ultimately the Bolshevik movement. If we look at the Russian Revolution, the October Revolution, which brought the Bolsheviks to power in 1917, not Lenin, of course, who was the preeminent leader of the Bolsheviks, but most of his top lieutenants were Jewish. And this is because of the double oppression to which Jews were subjected in Tsarist Russia as Jews and as poor people, as poor working people. So we have a whole set of responses, ranging from the hope for assimilation through education, the eradication of anti-Semitism, to revolutionary change, to emigration, to sticking to the old ways. And, of course, among all those tendencies, you have the emergence of Jewish nationalism, which comes to be called in the 1890s Zionism. And this, too, is not very surprising. If you look what goes on in Europe, across Europe, in the 19th century, this is the age of nationalism. This is the age in which one people after another develop new forms of national identity and come to feel that it's no longer acceptable for them to be ruled by people they come by empires, by states they come to see as alien and oppressive. And so in Italy, in Germany, in Greece, in Serbia, in Poland, across, and these, of course, are not nation-states at the time. They're empires. They're ruled by others. You have nationalist movements which seek to establish independent nation-states for this new category of people, which is usually defined by its language. Right? Before the 19th century, the idea that everybody who spoke German should be in one Germany would not have occurred to anyone. Or the idea that everybody who spoke Italian in all its dialects should be within one nation state called Italy, and that nation state should be independent of the rule of Austria or the other outside powers that dominate it, would not have occurred to anyone. People would not even have defined themselves as Italian first and foremost. But in the course of the 19th century, this idea of nationalism spreads very rapidly and challenges or disrupts and undermines all the old multi-ethnic polyglot empires. The Tsarist Empire, the Austro-Hungarian Empire, the German Empire certainly challenges them and helps lead to their collapse at the end of the First World War. So it's no surprising in this situation that some Jews began to feel that what they too needed to escape from anti-Semitism, to achieve equality within Europe, was a nation state of their own. This was a minority movement. There were, before the 1880s, that you can find a few voices who begin to talk about this. Most religious Jews had no interest in this because from their point of view, one had to wait, a proper Jew had to wait for the coming of the Messiah to escape exile, to escape persecution. And only when the Messiah came and the end of days arrived, could Jews be restored to their ancestral homeland, the house of David would be restored, and we'd have the what Christians would later call the kingdom of heaven on earth. So religious Jews were not interested in political projects of this kind. Certainly socialist Jews were also not interested. They wanted to change the societies they lived in so the Jews would have equal rights and better opportunities and be able to be full members of their society. And the many Jews in Central and Western Europe who had achieved legal equality in Germany and France and Britain and elsewhere also wanted to be part of their society. They wanted to be full citizens of liberal democracies. And the idea that they should pick themselves up and go somewhere else to try to achieve that seemed to them counterproductive or counterintuitive. In fact, it seemed to them to be accepting the basic arguments of the anti-Semites, who said the Jews were not part of European society or not part of German or French or British or whatever society, that they were aliens and didn't really belong. And that's exactly what many secularized, fairly assimilated Jews had been fighting to overcome. So Zionism is very much a minority movement. It got a little bit of traction in Eastern Europe in the 1880s and 90s as part of the reaction to the wave of anti-Semitic violence, aided and abetted in many cases by the Tsarist government, which was quite viciously anti-Semitic. And you begin to have in the 1880s, 90s, small groups of people who begin organizing themselves, raising money, and trying to plan the emigration of Jews out of Eastern Europe to a place where they can create a homeland of their own. Now, for most of these people, the only place that makes some sense to them is Palestine, the land of Israel, which has very powerful religious resonance, certainly for religious Jews, but even for Jews who have left religion in the strict sense. This was the place where, for Jews, the events of the Bible took place, where the events of the Jews when they had sovereignty were located. So it was not surprising that you have small groups of people who pick themselves up and try to establish agricultural settlements in Palestine, which is then part of the Ottoman Empire, with the hope of thereby launching an effort to achieve the national rebirth of the Jewish people, national redemption. It's a small-scale project. Compared to the vast numbers of Jews who emigrate and go to the United States or go to Western Europe, it's a drop in the bucket. It's a tiny, tiny minority. It's a couple of percent of that wave of out-migration from Europe. But it's there, and they do establish in the 1880s and 90s some numbers of new agricultural settlements because they very much want to become rooted in the soil. They feel the Jews should be sort of peasants, and you can see the influence here of a certain Tolstoyan romantic nationalism. They want to be rooted in their ancestral homeland. That's where they can connect to the land that was theirs once and which will be theirs again, and thereby be the vanguard of this project of national rebirth. Their numbers are small. We're talking of some thousands of people. Zionism becomes a modern international political movement only at the very end of the 1890s. And here the figure of Theodor Herzl is crucial, who was a Viennese journalist, actually of Hungarian origin, but moved to Vienna, the capital of the Austro-Hungarian Empire, made a name for himself as a journalist and a playwright, very assimilated, knew almost nothing of Jewish tradition from a non-religious family, but by the mid-1890s came to feel that anti-Semitism was not eradicable. It could not be eliminated. Partly he got this from covering the Dreyfus trial in France in 1894 as a journalist for a Vienna newspaper. And it was a big shock to him, although he'd already been moving in this direction, to see French mobs in the streets chanting death to the Jews. And this was in Paris, which was the homeland of the Enlightenment, where the principles of the French Revolution had supposedly taken root, where Jews had full political equality, were full citizens, and yet anti-Semitism persisted. So Herzl latched onto this idea that the only solution to the Jewish problem was for the Jews to leave Europe, or leave wherever they emigrated to, because he argued wherever they moved to, even if they moved to the United States, in a sense they would cause greater anti-Semitism by their presence. And in the end, this would lead to discrimination, tension, friction, exclusion, so they'd simply have to move onward. So for Herzl, the only way out was to have the Jews move somewhere where they could become a majority, where they could achieve a state of their own ultimately, and then, with a state of their own, would be accepted as equals by their fellow Europeans. And even if some stayed behind, they would then be like expatriates of any other country, and they would have a basis for equality. And it was Herzl who turned what had been a sort of amorphous, underfunded, not well-organized network of sort of local Zionist societies in Central and Eastern Europe into a well-organized, highly institutionalized, and quite effective political movement. He convened the first Zionist Congress, a meeting of delegates from across Europe in Basel, Switzerland in 1897, that the new Zionist organization he founded, and which he led for the years until his death, developed all sorts of institutions. It developed financial arms. It developed a land purchasing agency to buy land for Jewish settlement. And he took it upon himself to represent the Jews. He'd in effect declared himself the sole legitimate representative of the Jewish people, and went from European capital to European capital trying to convince the powers of Europe to facilitate this project, to sign on to this project, to get for the Jews some piece of land somewhere in which they could establish their homeland. Herzl didn't care very much where that was. If you read his pamphlet, The Jewish State, he talks about Argentina as well as Palestine, because at the time, many Europeans saw Argentina as this vast, empty place which was suitable for European settlement. And in fact, some Jews were going to settle in Argentina at that very moment. So he wasn't that concerned, but within a couple of years, the Zionist movement fixated on Palestine because it was clear nowhere else on earth had the kind of emotional resonance and historical depth of connection for Jews than Palestine. Again, than the land of Israel, which Jews, whether they were religious or secular, conceived of as their ancestral homeland. So you have the launching of this movement, which is trying in terms of its day-to-day actions to get Jews to move to Palestine, settle there, create new settlements, new towns, and also claiming to act politically on behalf of the Jews. Now, it's important to remember that when Zionism emerges as an organized political movement around 1900, the last years of the 19th century, the first years of the 20th century, it's rejected by most Jews. Religious Jews rejected, Orthodox Jews rejected, because for them it's a false messianism. It's what Jews, from their point of view, need is not a nation state. They need to live according to God's commandments, which one can do anywhere. And again, await the coming of the Messiah for the eventual return to the land of Israel. And any human action is a way preempting God. It's doing something which only God can do. So the Orthodox rabbis condemned Zionism at its origins very, very vigorously. They denounced the Zionists as idolaters. They worshipped the state rather than God's law. They were secularizing. They were leading the youth away from religion, which they also didn't like. They were substituting the nation for God's law. So Zionism was rejected from that quarter. It was rejected by most secular assimilated Jews in Western Europe, who again saw this as feeding into the arguments of the anti-Semites. They wanted to be equal citizens of Germany or Austria-Hungary or France or Britain. They didn't want to have to pick up and leave, and they rejected the notion that they should. And similarly, Zionism was rejected by the many Jews who were attracted to socialism, especially in Eastern Europe, who felt that Zionism was a sort of crackpot idea, a pipe dream, and that instead of running away to Palestine, Jews should stay and fight for their rights wherever they happen to live and demand equality and demand the transformation of society such that there would be a society of justice and equality, a society of socialism, in which Jews could could live along with non-Jews as decent human beings and have their own particular cultural distinctiveness recognized and supported instead of suppressed. So Zionism remains very much a minority movement among Jews for many decades, and really down to the Second World War, down to the end of the Second World War. And there were many other currents in Jewish life which were non-Zionist or anti-Zionist. In Palestine itself, which is the focus of the Zionist movement as it gets organized, its successes are limited. It does succeed in the years leading up to the First World War in bringing under its auspices some thousands of Jews to settle, some in new agricultural settlements of various kinds, some in the towns, a new Jewish town which will eventually become a very large city. Tel Aviv is founded around 1909 as the first exclusively Jewish city in Palestine. But it's a slow process. It's sort of acre after acre, immigrant after immigrant. Its prospects for success still seem very limited in 1914, and largely because the Zionist movement is much less successful at getting a big power sponsor. Palestine is part of the Ottoman Empire, and the Ottoman government in Istanbul has lost a lot of its territory to foreign encroachment. It's very sensitive to what it sees as outsiders coming in and talking about taking away some other part of it, and especially Palestine, which for Muslims, of course, also has a lot of religious resonance. The Ottoman government sees these Zionist immigrants not so much as Jews, but as Russians. And Russia is the traditional enemy of the Ottoman Empire, and it doesn't like these Russians coming in and claiming the protection of their ambassadors and their consuls to get special privileges. So the Ottomans are trying to stop the Zionists from buying land. They're trying to restrict immigration. After 1908, when there's a constitutional revolution in the Ottoman Empire, there's suddenly a free press, there are elections to the Ottoman parliament, and you begin to have Arabs in Palestine taking note of this Zionist movement, raising objections to it. You begin to have local conflicts over land ownership, because as the Zionist organizations or as Jews buy land, the peasants who live on that land are being dispossessed. They're protesting. So you already have calls in the Ottoman parliament on the Ottoman government to restrict land sales, to restrict immigration. It's becoming an issue already. The Ottoman government has no interest in a Jewish state in some part of the Ottoman Empire, or even a Jewish majority in Palestine. And Zionism, despite Herzl's efforts and despite the efforts of his successors, also don't succeed in selling the idea to any big power in Russia, in Europe, without whose support they're not going to get very far. They lobby the British government, the French government, the German government, the Russian government, on and on. But they all see this as not a very likely prospect. They have other fish to fry. They're not very interested. So if you'd look at the situation in 1914, Zionism's prospects for success don't seem very large. Palestine is overwhelmingly an Arab country, and the great majority of its Arab population is Muslim, with a Christian minority. Increasingly, its Arab population are coming, or at least the more educated, urbanized elements, coming to see themselves as Arabs also in a new national sense, because nationalism is also penetrating the Middle East. And as the Ottoman Empire is getting increasingly decrepit and creaky and unable to protect itself, some of its constituent peoples, including both Turks and Arabs, come to see themselves a little less as Ottomans and a little more as Turks or as Arabs. So there's a growing sense of not quite an Arab nationalism yet, but of an Arab identity, which doesn't accommodate Zionism, of course, which sees Palestine as Arab, as it is, in fact, demographically, and has been for many, many centuries, and sees Zionism as a threat, still a distant threat. It's hard to imagine that there could be a Jewish state given the small size of the Jewish population, not all of whom are even Zionists, but it's becoming an issue, and there is a heightened sense of Arab identity, awareness, self-definition by 1914 already. The First World War changes the situation pretty dramatically, because the Ottoman Empire ends up joining Germany and Austria-Hungary in the war, because their main threat is Britain and France, so it's not surprising that they ally themselves with Germany and Austria. Britain has taken over Egypt next door. France has designs on parts of the Middle East, so the Ottomans feel Germany is a much better bet. Germany has no colonial ambitions in the Middle East, as Britain and France do. But that turns out to be the losing side as things develop. And by 1917, British forces invading from Egypt are conquering Palestine from the Ottomans and heading north along the coast. And the First World War gives the Zionist movement the opportunity to find the big power sponsor it had been dreaming of since Herzl's time for the previous 20 years. Herzl dies early on, but his successors continue his efforts. And in 1917, the British government essentially endorses the Zionist project. The British Foreign Secretary, Lord Balfour, issues what becomes known as the Balfour Declaration, in which the British government officially endorses the idea of creating in Palestine a national home for the Jewish people. The formulation was deliberately vague. The British spent a lot of time thinking about the wording, and they wanted to fudge it as much as possible. At the same time, they were making other promises to Arab nationalists who had revolted with British funding and military support against the Ottomans, and had promised the Arabs to help create an independent Arab state after the war, which the Arabs thought included Palestine. And at the same time, the British were making secret treaties with France and Russia about how to divide up the Middle East into new colonial spheres of control. So completely contradictory promises. The British created the greatest empire in the world, not by honest dealings exactly, but by doing just this kind of thing. From their point of view, the goal was to win the war, and whatever helped with that, they were willing to do. And after the war, they would sort out these contradictory promises. So they endorse Zionism, and when the war ends and the victors, the Allies, sit down at Versailles to work out the terms, they draw lots of new lines on the map. They create the Middle East more or less as we know it today. The modern states of the Middle East are drawn by the Allies after the First World War, out of the remnants of the former Arab provinces of the Ottoman Empire. And among other things, the British create a new entity called Palestine, and say that the Balfour Declaration, their promise to support the Zionist movement in creating a national home for the Jewish people, whatever exactly that means, in Palestine, will be applied, will be part of their mission, their commitment in Palestine. The British don't rule Palestine directly because it's a little embarrassing at this late date, after all the talk by President Wilson of self-determination, to just simply take over as a direct colonial ruler. They create a new system, which is, in reality, a thinly disguised form of colonial rule, the mandate system. So technically, Britain and France are mandatory powers. They're sort of trustees. And their job is to lead, in Britain's case, Palestine, eventually Transjordan and Iraq, to independence eventually. And France is to lead Syria and Lebanon, which it gains control of towards independence. But in reality, the British and French are running the show. This is a tremendous victory for Zionism. It finally has the big power backer. And in the 20s and 30s, you begin to have migration on a larger scale into Palestine. So the percentage of Jews of the population in Palestine gradually increases, with setbacks. It's uneven. But you begin to get the laying of the foundations of a distinct Jewish society in Palestine. And of course, for Zionism, the goal is not to bring Jews to Palestine so that they assimilate into the indigenous Arab population. The goal is to create a separate Jewish society, and eventually a Jewish majority, and eventually a Jewish state in Palestine. So economically, politically, culturally, the drive is towards separatism, to separate from the Arab population, to build a whole Jewish society from, as the joke goes, from Jewish prostitutes, Jewish street sweepers, all the way up the social ladder, to the greatest extent possible, separate from the surrounding majority Arab society. And increasingly in the 20s and 1930s, this Jewish society, under British protection, creates the foundations, lays the foundations of a distinct Jewish society, and even a future Jewish state, because this society has elected institutions, it has semi-governmental institutions, it has its own school system, it sets up its own military, its own paramilitary, the Haganah, which will eventually be the nucleus of the future Israeli army after 1948, and so on. It's an uneven process, and it's important, I think, to emphasize that none of this would have been possible without British support and protection. Because the indigenous Arab population, from the beginning, once the Ottoman Empire was gone, began demanding independence for Palestine and opposed Zionism. From their point of view, the British had come in, they had, and with a promise to give their country to these outsiders. So the Arab national movement, which emerges in Palestine, is vociferously opposed to Zionism, which they feel is aiming at reducing them to a minority in their own homeland. They feel this is a gross violation of the right of self-determination. They're the majority. Palestine should be an Arab state. and with Jews as a minority. And certainly without being open to immigration from the outside, which threatens to change the demographic balance. So Zionism, from early on, but certainly quite visibly in the 1920s and 30s, faces growing opposition from the indigenous Arab nationalist movement.
You're listening to Zachary Lockman, A Brief History of Zionism. This is Independent Alternative Radio. For copies of this program, call us 1-800-444-1977 or online, our website, alternativeradio.org.
And it's only British protection that makes Zionism possible. The presence of a colonial government that's committed to fostering the Zionist project. Not always as much as the Zionist movement would like, there are tensions, but if we conduct a thought experiment and imagine that in 1918, 1917, the British do not take control of Palestine, or agree that Palestine should be a state run by its Arab majority, it's clear there is no Zionism. That's the end of the story, because that Arab majority would simply put an end to this project, which threatens its presence, it threatens it with dispossession. And Arabs come to understand very quickly that, you know, despite the nice talk of coexistence, and Zionist leaders talk a lot about coexistence, we can live together, there's plenty of room in this country for all of us. Inevitably, if you're trying to create a Jewish majority and a Jewish state in what is an overwhelmingly Arab country, this means dispossession. It may mean expulsion, but at a minimum, it means dispossession. It means that the majority will be transformed into minority in its own homeland. And as many Zionist leaders acknowledge privately, if not always publicly, anybody would oppose such a thing, right? Any indigenous population would resist such a thing. And the more far-sighted and hard-headed of the Zionist leaders were already saying very clearly in the 1920s, of course the Arabs will oppose us. And there's no peaceful resolution to this in sight, and the only thing that will decide this is superior force. So ultimately, we have to build up our strength such that we can overcome their resistance and carve out, by force if necessary, a Jewish state in this land, or transform it into a Jewish state, however long that takes and by whatever means prove necessary. Most Zionist leaders were uncomfortable with that formulation, but I think that reflects the logic of the situation very clearly. And this is, I think, very graphically demonstrated in the later 1930s when, in 1936, there was a full-scale Arab revolt against British rule and against the Zionist enterprise, which British rule protected.